It's time for Let's Talk Legal with Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins from the law firm of Harvell and Collins.
It's Let's Talk Legal on the Talk Station FM 107.1. And joining us this afternoon, Wes Collins of Harvell and Collins. Normally, we have both Cecil and Wes on, but today we have Wes. And with that, Wes, good afternoon to you. Thanks for joining us.
Good afternoon, Lockwood.
What's happening in the world of legal discourse and debate and, well, activities?
Yesterday, I was in court in Carter County Superior Court and had multiple dispositive motions. So I thought I'd talk a little bit about what dispositive motions are
yeah.
for the litigation. I mean, obviously, the word dispositive means to dispose of a case. So those are very important motions and important hearings because there's a lot of prep that goes into those in order to present the evidence, to present the law properly to the court. Because if you don't do that, then if you're the one defending the dispositive motion, then your case might get dismissed.
Uh-huh.
And obviously that's a pretty significant event that we want to avoid if we're the case. If we're on the other side and we're moving for a dispositive motion to dismiss a case, of course we want to win that so that the case is resolved in our favor. So the different types of dispositive motions, the ones I want to talk about are really fall into two different categories. You have what we call a 12B motion. Now, that can be things like fair to join a necessary party, like if a party has to be in the case but they haven't been brought in yet,
uh-huh.
well, that can be grounds for dismissing it. Like yesterday, there was a hearing that some other attorneys were handling, and the argument, I was in the courtroom and listened to it, but the argument was whether the state of North Carolina would be allowed to intervene in a particular case involving some beachfront property in Carter County.
Mm-hmm.
And there was an argument there with regard to whether the state had any interest in potentially the rights of the parties, or maybe they owned part of the property that was in question. So the court ultimately, after hearing the motion, then allowed them to come in. And, kind of one of those arguments there was that if they weren't a party and they're a necessary party, then that would be grounds for the case to not even be able to go forward.
Right.
Because, if you make a determination on the rights of everyone and someone didn't have a right to come to court and raise their issues and exercise due process, then it's, the case could be basically for nothing.
Mm-hmm. It would
be a nullity. So you have that. You have other types of issues like of lack of service of process or jurisdiction, those type of issues. But the primary area where we get to a motion to dismiss under a 12B is called a 12B6. And basically what that is under Rule 12B6 of the North Carolina Rules of Civil Procedure, and I'm talking about state law here, but federal law is very similar, even falls under the same rule numbers. That's a failure to state a claim for which relief can be granted. That's just you look at all the pleadings. You look at the complaint that was filed. You look at the things that were filed with the courthouse, the documents, okay? And this is normally pretty much at the beginning of the case. And the court is going to look at all of that and make a determination as a matter of law whether there is a claim there, whether there's not a claim there, and I'll get into that in more detail in just a minute. So you see, you don't take into consideration on a 12B6, Lockwood, other evidence such as depositions,
right?
Such as affidavits, such as evidence outside of the pleadings.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then the other type of dispositive motion, as you heard me talk about before, summary judgment. And that's under Rule 56, and basically what that is where the court is looking at the law, of course, but looks outside of the pleadings. Like you might be putting before the court deposition transcripts, affidavits, testimony in written form, not in live testimony in court, and the court considers all that to determine whether there's a what's called a genuine issue of material fact.
Mm-hmm.
So these are all like, okay, when you get a dispositive motion from the other side, then you kind of, you know, obviously you put that on your calendar first, you know when that hearing is, you know when your brief is due, and you've got to really put a lot of focus in it. It's not like you just show up in court and argue it. There's a
right.
lot of prep involved in it. So let me talk a little bit about a couple of the ones I had yesterday, not mentioning any names, but just to give some context to the listeners about how these things work. One case I had was a situation where we have a mother and a daughter and a son, and the mother had signed a power of attorney in favor of the daughter, and so the daughter was the agent under the power of attorney, and had also signed a deed. And so the son was not happy with what the mother had done and basically alleged in a lawsuit that he filed that the power of attorney should be set aside because of her lack of capacity and undue influence mm-hmm. by the daughter and those type things. Now, I represented the daughter and the mother. So I had on a motion to dismiss, and the basis of that motion to dismiss is based on standing, okay? That standing is generally a concept where the court determines whether you have a right, whether you're the true party in interest. Whether you, like if someone trespasses on your property, Lockwood, I don't have any right to sue them about
right.
that.
Right.
You do.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I can for you as your attorney, but you're my client on
right.
that. So it would, you know, kind of sounds like maybe under this scenario, if the son is not happy with what the mother has done and wants to challenge it and argues that the power of attorney was not appropriate, then he would have the right to do that.
Exactly.
But the law in North Carolina is very well laid out in multiple cases. And again, this is, as we talk about the precedent, the cases from our Court of Appeals and our Supreme Court in North Carolina gives us direction on who has standing in this situation. And the way that this case was brought, the son did not have standing to bring that suit. And because the mother is still living, and because he is not her guardian. So what are the avenues for that son to address this issue? He can't bring a suit directly to try to set this document aside, because whose claim is it? Who has the right to do that? Well, it's the mother's claim.
Mm-hmm.
She's the one who has the right to bring that claim if she wants to. Now, if the mother is incompetent or she lacks capacity to be able to make decisions for herself, now the son could petition for adjudication of incompetence.
Right.
And attempt to be appointed as her guardian, and then address that through a lawsuit on her behalf during her lifetime.
Uh-huh.
And then the only other avenue that the son would have would be after she passes away, if he is a beneficiary under her estate, like if the will leaves him something, then under the argument that, well, the use of this power of attorney, depleted my inheritance.
Right.
I'm asking you, the executor, assuming that the daughter was the executor, to address this issue. And if you don't do it, then that son would have the right to bring that claim directly. That's under a case called Horry v. Woodbury. It's actually under a case called Olshner, too, that I just took up to the Court of Appeals last year, where the Court of Appeals came back and gave a lot of clarification on the issue about a beneficiary asking an executor to do something in an estate, like try to collect a debt
mm-hmm.
or try to set a power of attorney aside or try to bring a lawsuit. And if you don't do it, then that beneficiary can bring the claim themselves under certain circumstances.
Right.
So you kind of see there, this hearing actually never went to actual hearing because opposing counsel in the case came to me before the hearing as we were sitting in court and asked me what my position was on it,
mm-hmm.
why I thought it should be dismissed, and I explained what I just explained here on the on the radio,
right?
What the problems were with it, and he agreed that he wanted to take it off the calendar and not go forward with it, and then we would discuss it, later, and so basically his situation was his client has very limited rights to do anything about this now, but would have rights upon mother's passing away.
Right, right.
That's just kind of the way it is.
Yeah.
As a side note, one of the reasons he wanted to set that power of attorney aside is because the daughter in a separate lawsuit is suing him for money he took from mom using that power of attorney. Mm-hmm. So it would be nice if the power of attorney got set aside because then there'd be nobody to prosecute that lawsuit against him.
Right, right.
So that's so a lot of moving parts with that.
Yeah.
But that's just the way it is, Lockwood, with litigation. I mean, you've got to understand all these moving parts in order to properly represent your client.
One of the things we've talked about, and of course in the past couple of weeks, we've been talking about the issue of how lawyers bill and why they bill and the work they're doing. And we're about to go to break here in a moment, but Wes, I want to come back to this after the break. I think you've pointed out an issue that many of us never consider, and that's the depth of preparation. You're listening to Let's Talk Legal. Today we have Wes Collins of Harvell & Collins. Normally we do have Cecil Harvell but we're talking about the issue of dispositive motions. Very interesting story here. And I want to remind folks, go to the website, harvellandcollins.com. Spell out the word and, harvellandcollins.com. And the number, 252 area code, 726-9050, 726-9050. It's Harvell and Collins. And again, we're talking with Wes Collins here on Let's Talk Legal about dispositive motions. A moment ago, Wes, we were talking about this one particular case. And one of the things that leapt out at me is that you, as either the defense attorney or the plaintiff's attorney, either one, if you're looking to dispose of a case or seek dismissal or you're preparing for someone requesting a dismissal, you've got to do a lot of preparatory work before. I mean, this is an important, as I'm hearing from you, this is a very important step because this could determine the future of the case. Am I accurate in that description?
No doubt about it. And that's kind of the way you analyze a case from the very beginning. If you're going to bring the claim, you start thinking right from the beginning, do we have what we need to get through
uh-huh.
a 12B6 to get through a summary judgment? Because depending on who the defendant is, if you have let's say you have a bank as the defendant, let's
uh-huh.
say there's something involved with a bank, let's say there's something involved with a mortgage company, let's say there's something involved with an insurance company. Well, I can tell you their analysis in many cases is going to be, are we going to be able to get this dismissed on 12B6 or summary judgment? Because those type of corporate entities in many cases don't want a jury to making decisions
mm-hmm.
on the, because they're not generally well liked. When you end up in a litigation context with 12 people deciding whether this individual is in the right or whether this big bank is in the right, So you really analyze it from a legal perspective. It requires you to, do that, do the work relative to the 12B6 and the summary judgment. That is certainly something that's very important in ACE. But I would also say that, you can kind of tell as I think that when I talk about this, I'm able to rattle this off pretty quickly, these facts and how these situations transpired, so on and so forth. Well, I mean, that's, they call it the practice of law because you're practicing. You're getting better through practice. every year you do it. And so, you know, this is, it's not like, you know, this is the first time I've handled a case like this kind of case. So after you practice it, just like, you know, any other seasoned attorney, you know, you're going to understand these moving parts with regard to these things. But the law is a living and breathing thing. I mean, the next case I'm going to tell you about, really there's a new case that came down from the Supreme Court in 2021 that really kind of changes the landscape with regard to this next case that I'm going to tell you about that I dealt with yesterday. So let me jump into that. So this case was about a young couple who bought a home. And when you buy a home, a residential property, then there's a requirement for there to be a residential property disclosure statement. That's a form document that the realtors provide. Okay, that's prepared by the North Carolina Real Estate Commission. And Lockwood, it goes through like different parts of the home. Like, is there any issue with the windows? Right. Yes, no representation. Is there any issue with the fountain? Yes, no representation. Is there an issue with termite infestation? Yes, no representation. Is there an issue with any type of rot or water infiltration?
Right.
Yes, no representation. So once you buy the property and you close, you are basically subject to caveat emptor.
Buyer beware.
Yes, exactly. It basically means that, okay, you've had the opportunity to do your inspections. You've had your opportunity to negotiate based on things you found that may be a problem. You know, but you're buying it as is, where is. Okay? So that's basically, you know, how that cookie crumbles. So be careful when you buy a home, and always get a home inspection and read it closely and follow the instructions of the inspector. That's kind of side advice. So basically, my clients, they bought a home. They knew about some issues, and that's not denied. They knew there were some roof issues. They knew that there were some issues with some of the pipes, plumbing issues in the home, and maybe a handful of other issues, and they bought the property, and they negotiated on those other issues, and the price came down some. But then about a year after they moved into the property, they found that there was widespread rot. There was some very significant things that were done to try to cover these things up. They spent over $200,000 fixing all the problems with the home. They had an active termite infestation. So there were a lot of problems way beyond what they knew about.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so the law on that, basically, since it was probably been 15 years. Really, that kind of was set in stone, I would say, in a case called Madden B. Loof out of Craven County. That case dealt with a person, Ms. McFadden, who bought a property, who she got a home inspection, and the home inspector said, well, there's some issues with the roof. You need to have the roof inspected by a qualified roofing contractor.
Right.
Well, she didn't do that. She went ahead and bought it anyway. And then she had very significant leaking issues with the roof. And now this is like a slate roof. It's really expensive,
mm-hmm.
like months later. So she files a lawsuit against the seller saying that, you know, it has grounded in fraud, okay? So
right.
That's because, you know, it's buyer beware, but if you're defrauded in some way, you have that claim, okay? You do have the claim, but there's certain things you have to do. So basically, under that McFadden v. Loof case, it meandered through the courts up to the Court of Appeals, and the Court of Appeals came back and said, because it was dismissed on a summary judgment at the trial level, the Court of Appeals came back and said, well, Ms. McFadden, you don't have a claim because you did not exercise reasonable reliance
mm-hmm.
when you bought the property because you got an inspection and your inspector said to get a qualified roof contractor, you didn't do that.
Right.
So you're out of court.
Right.
Okay. So that's really been the law on that pretty consistently for a relatively long period of time, 15 years or so. So maybe a little bit longer than that. So now this case comes down, which is a Cummings case. It's regarding a beach house. It's a 22-page opinion from our Supreme Court. And basically, this is 2021 case. Basically, what this Cummings case says, or what it dealt with, was a guy who bought a property on the beach and at home inspection, and there were about five or six different areas where the inspector said, these are problems here, you need to have this reviewed by a contractor.
Right.
And one of the areas that was identified was the windows would not operate well because they're like the roll-out kind of windows.
Uh-huh.
So he buys the house for a lot of money, and then ends up finding out later that none of the windows were open.
Right.
They just won't work. So the logic behind McFadden v. Loof was basically seemed to apply there, mm-hmm. because he didn't follow through with the recommended inspections that his home inspector said to do. Well, surprisingly, the Supreme Court comes back and says, well, there's enough factual issue here in this case about whether this buyer should have known or should not have known the extent of the damage. It's a jury question, so it found that summary judgment should not have been granted and kicked it back to the trial court. So that case, I don't really know what the final disposition of it is, but I know what that opinion is. So that's the law of the land with regard to that now. So if you have basically what it's come down to is that if you have a particular item that you know about that's pretty easy to identify, like a roof,
mm-hmm.
then you better get that inspection if your home inspector says to get a general contractor to inspect it. But if you have more of a myriad of issues where you have multiple things, then it becomes a factual issue about what you knew or what you should have known. And it's murky at this point in time. So at any rate, on my client's particular case, the opposition was proceeding forward on a 12B6, arguing McFadden v. Loof. And in response, I was showing to the court and arguing the Cummings case. And, given the opinion in the Cummings case with the rollout windows and that new opinion, the court had no choice but to deny their motion for 12B6 because you have to take all the allegations in the complaint as true on a 12B6. And okay. We made all the proper allegations. And so now we get into a factual determination as to really to what extent are they entitled to any kind of recovery or claim or not, and we have to get into, what they knew, what they didn't know, what mm-hmm. the experts say, what further inspection may have revealed, those kind of things. So you understand, I'm having to, with this 12B, to just explain to you, kind of navigate through multiple cases and kind of wind them together and intertwine right. them in order to get to a point where I can properly argue this, to the court. And I've got to, frankly, make sure that my research is entirely current.
Yeah.
Because if I don't know about the Cummings case, and I'm arguing, and I haven't done my research, then I'm at a point where, the McFadden v. Loof standard may result in my client's case being dismissed. Well, mm-hmm. I have that. I've got to do my job.
This does apply to our previous conversations about the work that lawyers do. And here you're in a situation where you're actually defending or opposing a dispositive motion or a dismissal. You've got to sort of, it's almost like a chess game. You've got to be prepared for what the next move is, yet there are multiple moves, and they could greatly determine where you would argue the case, or for that matter, what the following motion might be.
No doubt about it. I mean, there's a lot of strategy involved. You hope to know what the other side's position is going to be, and there are some rules with regard to how early you have to serve your briefs so that the court, that's really more for the court than anyone else, so they're up to speed,
yeah,
you know, with regard to what the arguments are. I mean, it's not, let's say that, you know, for example, you prepare a brief, but then you locate a case that's really helpful to you very shortly before the hearing, and you've already served your brief. Well, it's not as though when you go to court, you can't argue this case as well, because the court is going to consider the case on the law,
mm-hmm,
not just limited to what you wrote in your brief. And if you have, you know, law that's helpful or to your side or the other side, the court will take that into consideration. So, but, you know, the way this works is, I mean, these superior court judges and really judges in court of appeals, Supreme Court, so on and so forth, a lot of times they're seeing these issues in, you know, maybe they haven't dealt with these particular issues
right,
ever before, or maybe they have, but the facts are probably going to be different than the last case they dealt with that was similar to this.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to realize that they have a very finite and limited amount of time to hear what you're arguing to them when the attorney has spent hours and hours and hours working on the case to know where we are with everything so that it can be presented to the court in a very logical and succinct manner. You can't overload a judge, you know, you got a 1-hour summary judgment hearing or 12B6 hearing.
Wow.
Well, I mean, you've got to kind of boil it down to what the points are, because, you know, like for yesterday, I mean, the judge in Superior Court heard, you know, 10 or 12 different matters, or 8 or 10, 12, something like that, different matters. So it's a lot for a judge to take in a short period of time. They're at somewhat of a disadvantage because the attorneys have plenty of time to prepare for whatever, you know, the issues are. So you really got to do your homework and make it easily digest for the judge. And that comes from preparation before you get there.
You know, this, and of course, again, we're talking with Wes Collins of Harvell and Collins. And let me remind you very quickly, the number, 252 area code 726-9050, but also online at harvellandcollins.com. You know, Wes, the fact of the matter is, that's where I enjoy these conversations. We see, if you will, the culmination of your work. We don't realize the hours and of preparation, but not only that, the vagaries, for want of a better description, of your preparation. Are you preparing for a dismissal? And if you're doing that, how do you prepare for that? And at the same time, you're looking towards eventually solving the case, hopefully before you go to court, or if you are in court. So you've got multiple tracks. You're spending a lot of time on just one case, and that's not the only client you have. So there's a lot of time that you have to dedicate. How do you go about doing that?
that is, I think that's the, I mean, I enjoy my work, and I enjoy the mental, you know, challenges and the strategy. I enjoy trying cases. I enjoy getting good results for clients. I enjoy being very prepared. I can't help but be any other way. It bothers me to death if I'm not. Probably the most difficult and frustrating thing about my job, I mean, I guess there's several things that I would identify, but enjoy my work very much, but it's to be able to move a case along as quickly as I want to,
right,
when you have the load you have to deal with. Like, for example, I was in court basically all along yesterday dealing with these several cases. Okay, well, today I have to go back, and I think I have some time on my calendar, and I have to go, since I won my motions yesterday, I have to go prepare orders. So I have to go do all that. Well, you know, I'm sure my email inbox is completely full, so I've got to catch up on all of that too. So I have to, I have to certainly, let my clients know it's going to take time to get to these things, but when I get to them, I'm going to give full focus on them and concentration. And so, kind of just not being able to get to things quite as quickly as I would want to, because the demands of all the cases, and you can only do one thing at a time. So yeah, the challenges of having multiple balls up in the air at any point in time. I mean, I can handle it from a stress level mentally, because I'm pretty good at compartmentalizing and doing one thing at a time, because that's the only way you can do it. Multitasking as well, but the multitasking is more like, oh, got to get this done.
Right.
Delegate, but think about Lockwood, since you bring this issue up, when I go try a case and I'm out of the office for a week,
mm-hmm.
I mean, everybody else's cases just have to sit there.
Right.
They just sit there. Maybe my associates are moving things along to a extent, but you're out of the office for a week. I mean, you're paying for it for a month. It just takes a while to catch up. But that's just the nature of the beast. Wow. It's fine. You just have to balance all those things. So.
That's one of the reasons why I enjoy the conversations with you. And again, we're talking with Wes Collins of Harvell and Collins. We're as we've noted in the past, removing the mystery of law and the fact that it is hard work and takes a lot of time, as we've talked about in the past. So in the process of thinking about any activities in preparation of your future, I might add, don't hesitate to give the folks at Harvell and Collins a call. That number, 252 area code 726-9050, or better yet, go online to harvellandcollins.com to get all the information you're probably looking for, and then give them a call. Again, that's Harvell and Collins, spell out the word and, harvellandcollins.com. Again, it's always a joy to have Cecil and Wes, and today it's Wes Collins of Harvell and Collins here on Let's Talk Legal. Wes, look forward to next week. Thanks for your time.
Thank you, Lockwood.